Thank you very much. My name is Evan Harris. I'm the MP for Oxford West Abingdon. I'm delighted to have been asked to host this lunchtime's discussion on the James Martin School. Having said that, most of the work, in fact all the work for organising this event has been done by people other than me, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Caroline Cole in particular for the work she's done in organising this event. What we're going to have is two presentations and then a Q&A on what we've heard in the presentations and, of course, anything else, although you can't guarantee that things will be answered, just like in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. I'd firstly like to introduce the speakers and then we'll hear their presentations. The first speaker is, I'm delighted to say, the director of the school, that's Ian Golden, who's been at the school since September 2006. Part of that, he was Vice President of the World Bank, and part of that, Chief Executive of the Development Bank in Southern Africa. Like me, he has probably more direct than me, South African roots. And in the brochure, you'll see that it's available, and you'll see what I've been totally unable to do in a brief summary, justice to his biography. He's going to be followed by Professor Sarah Harper, who's a professor of gerontology, which I, if I remember correctly from my medical student days, is about care of the elderly. And prior to coming to Oxford, she was at the University of Chicago, and she heads up the James Martin Institute into Research into Aging, which is a topical issue which apparently, I'm told, affects everyone, and is extremely topical in the House of Commons and House of Lords, as there have been select committee inquiries and indeed all party group inquiries into the issue, and there's a great deal of interest across government, I think it's fair to say, in the challenges, opportunities, into the challenges provided by an ageing society in public policy terms as well as the science. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over firstly to Dr. Golden to give his introduction.
Thank you very much, and thanks to you, Evan, for agreeing to host this. If I can just turn this around, I'll be able to see as well what I'm doing. Let's stand on the side. What I aim to do in about 35 minutes is give you a flavour for the sorts of issues that we're thinking about in the 21st century school, and particularly how these may relate to the public sector and those that are in government. And it's particularly opportune for us to be here in the Houses of Parliament. A principal purpose of the 21st century school is to have a policy impact. And this differentiates itself from some other research groups whose principal purpose is to advance knowledge for its own sake. We have four criteria for being in the school: working on a major problem or opportunity of the 21st century, being the best in the world at what we do, and that's obviously the Oxford criteria, having a policy impact which will affect those outcomes for the better, and making sure that what we do is additional to what's being done elsewhere, the value-added criteria. So this is opportune and important for us, and very much central to our work program. I won't try and predict the future. Anyone that does that is certain to be wrong, and that's not because they're not smart or don't have the best intelligence agencies in the world at their disposal. It's because we will always be wrong in imagining worlds that have not yet happened. And these things can change extremely rapidly. They do indeed change rapidly. And so only 3 years, for example, before Nelson Mandela was released, the Prime Minister of Britain was saying that would be something that we're only imagining how people are. And it wasn't only because of the biases. These things continue to happen in business, in the public sector, in politics. And what's important is trying to understand the major structural changes as they are likely to occur, and then, of course, what we can do and how we can influence them. So that is the purpose of the school, but it's certainly not futurology. Futurology, rightly, has a bad name, and part of our endeavour is to differentiate ourselves from all the futurologists around. The key question that we are thinking about is, how do we become wiser at making decisions about the future, that shape our future? How can we engage, informed by deep research, in a way which will ensure we don't stumble, as we have over the many millennia of the past, into problems I'll be able to somehow learn from experience, and in so doing, I'm informed by understanding the future, and behave differently, or to make it a happier place for everyone. So have you got any wiser? We've certainly got a lot smarter, I will argue, but our capacity to digest information is a lot more effective than it's ever been. But is this accompanied by an ability to act in better ways? Now, we live in a most remarkable time, a time when, for the first time for about 1,000 years, global population growth is being exceeded by global income growth, so that on average people are getting better off in the world. This is a time, rather like a time about 1,000 years ago, of great globalization, of the coming together of people, huge migration flows, idea flows, integration, bringing with it a more rapid pace, I would argue, of the evolution of ideas, and with that, potential and prosperity. This is a remarkable period. Note this is exponential growth rate, which you can be seen at the back. This is exponential growth rate, so this is truly, by historical standards, a phenomenal time. It's a time which is unlike any other in human history. It's the first time that there's been a massive population growth of over 2 billion people and improvements in income on average at the same time. It's the number of people absolutely living under, for example, the holiday down in the world. We think it's about 1 billion people now. Illiteracy has halved over the last 30 years in the world, and life expectancy has gone up by about 20 years. So, as you will always encounter, and looking at the debate on Zimbabwe that's going on at the moment, today in the House Parliament, people who are worried about the future, that is all certainly true, and we need to be deeply concerned about those that are still trapped in poverty. But that story is increasingly exceptional, in that the overwhelming majority of people who is coming out of this extremely rapid progress, most rapid progress ever, on the frontier in the dimension. Of course, we'll come back to the consequences of this for the environment and on the dimension and whether this is sustainable. A great uncertainty as to where this is going in all dimensions. And one of the extraordinary things about thinking about the future, and this isn't to the end of the century, 21st century school presumably should be thinking about the year 2099, this is only to 2050, but even over this 40-year range, we see this amazing divergence in population projections, about 4 billion people divergence in population projections. That's 2/3 of the current population of the Earth. And so any projection, and one used to think that demographic projections are more stable, and Sarah certainly is an expert in this area and can talk to the reasons for this, but even on these, we have great divergence of views. I am an optimist, putting me somewhere there, around hovering around 9 billion. Others are pessimists, around 12 billion. It matters desperately for the future to go. And of course, this is affected, as Sarah will emphasize, I'm sure most dramatically by things like women's education, inclusion, and labor force, and other factors. Life expectancy, Sarah will talk about, I won't dwell on it, but this is another cause for optimism going forward. Of course, the pace of these increases will affect the global population as well. And what happens in the Asians, particularly India and China being the big drivers of that sort of transformation. Remarkably, these are World Bank projections to 2030. It's the only real thinking about the future I did in my previous incarnation at the bank. But it wasn't very sophisticated. Effectively, what you'll see here is a future that looks like the past. The World Bank believes that the future growth rates will be very, very similar going forward than in the past. And indeed, there are many good reasons to believe that. There are no major structural changes over the future. And that's partly because this major trend, which has changed from about the year 1990 with the fall of the Berlin Wall and integration of economies, acceleration of globalization is different, but has been such with huge increases, increments in the growth rates of the different flows that link economies, and that is likely to continue, the current crises notwithstanding. And when you look at the long-run trends of markets, and this is, again, logarithmic scale, so it's much bigger pace of increase than this, maybe simply suggested by this, you see that the crises that we go through are blips in the long term. And this sort of thing is, okay, but the question is, can we continue to have exponential growth into the future in these different dimensions, or will something change? A lot of what is driving this has been this exponential growth in computing capacity. This is an interesting graph. It shows the crunching capacity, the millions of processors per second per $1,000. In other words, normalize my price in order to get a sense of what is affordable. Again, exponential growth on the one side. We are now about, within that $4,000, you can begin to get about a lizard capacity. We think by about 2025, we'll be human brain capacity. This is doubling every 18 months or so. Indeed, it's coming down. Moore, the famous Gordon Moore, who thought of the Moore's Law about the ability of crunching capacity to double every 18 months, I thought it would only happen for about three generations of processors, in other words, for about 5 years or something, or 10 years at max. In fact, if you speak to the people working in this at Oxford and elsewhere, they say this will happen for at least the next 20 years. We will continue our capacity to basically double computing capacity. The implications of doubling every 18 months are phenomenal. So my son's PlayStation 3 has a bigger, stronger capacity than the Deep Blue computer that beat Kasparov, strongest computer in the world, just over 10 years ago. So that's what happens when you double capacity. Certainly, my mobile phone, like yours, has more capacity than the first Apollo spacecraft and so on. What goes with this is a second phenomenon, which is miniaturization. Miniaturization, the development of the capacity to work with processes which are about a billionth of a meter in diameter, processes which are invisible to the human eye, and the development of machines which can, for example, develop to go into your bloodstream and so on. This is all happening. We have a number of nanogroups in Oxford who are working on the development of this sort of machine. And the big question is, what are the implications for it? And so we've started a nano and health group to look at that issue in particular. What happens when these things penetrate through your lungs, your kidneys, through your brain, and so on? Huge potential upsides for delivering chemicals to parts of the body through various magnetic and other induction, but also dangers that we don't know about. Is this a new speciosis? What are the implications of that? So, huge developments as well on technology, particularly biotechnology, tremendously exciting. The ability to develop not only crops and products which can take stress, which is extremely important in adapting to climate change, which have proteins and other nutritional elements built into them, but also producing other sorts of products like body parts through biotechnology. Extremely exciting. Obviously, sitting in Parliament, one can't help but be aware that these things engender enormous controversy in the public eye. And part of our mission is to think about the deep research in an analytic, objective way and make it available for those that then want to use it to help inform the public and talk about these issues. Perhaps the most remarkable stories are in medicine, medical technologies, biochemistry, and the associated areas, where there are enormous strides happening, which really do make some people believe that there's someone alive today that's going to live to, say, at least a couple of hundred years, and maybe around longer. But a lot depends on the ability to do regeneration. The stem cell work is tremendously exciting. The ability to develop the new Stem Cell Institute at Oxford, I saw the development of new nerve fibers, for example, that could be used to allow paraplegics to walk again, the development of heart cells, and so on. This is all things we're on the cusp of, bringing with it enormous potential. The question is, will this be available in the NHS? Are we moving to a society where the medical technologies of enhancement are going to be available, but they will not be available to public health systems, and so that the rich will not only be richer and have the normal historical ways of ensuring that their kids remain part of the elite and that's why through good education, nutrition, and everything else that we're familiar with, but actually physically to engineer them to be superior human beings in the sense of their physical attributes and their mental attributes. And so that sort of discussion, which we're having now with doping in sport is the discussion of the future, 10 times more significant and controversial, I imagine, for you than the person. These aging populations I won't dwell on because, again, Sarah will come back to this in her presentation. What I want to stress is that we have a series of risks. Many of these have been risks which have been around for as long as we have on the planet, things like famine, drought, and so on. But the coming together of all of these in a new constellation is what makes the big difference. This is why we are at a crossroads time, and particularly the ability of individuals to affect the global outcome. It's never before been possible for a single individual to wipe out a very large part of a place like England. And that is what's different about our current period. With a bioweapon, one could, of course, do that, this makes it different, raising enormous questions of the bridging of technology with surveillance, privacy, liberty, and the other questions. So that's one reason why the future looks different. The second is that we have much more complex and integrated systems. So the upside of globalization has been sharing of ideas, of potential, of trade, and so on. The downside is a much greater integration and dependence. So it's very difficult to imagine any element of our current society which doesn't depend on integration anymore. Be it financial markets, be it logistics supply, of oxygen to hospitals, food, power, whatever you want to think of, it's trade. That means that the fragility of the system is much greater, and small parts in logistical chain. The just-in-time phenomenon in business, of course, is also part of this. When there was a strike in Portugal of truckers, the Cowley plant in Oxford was affected very rapidly because of the lack of stocks in the just-in-time. So it's that sort of integration that means what happens is much more complex. So the impact of a pandemic, of any sort of event, is much more dramatic. The ability to accumulate wealth is also more concentrated. So if you did create a group of people that were superhumans, their impact would be global rather than just in their community that they lived. That's just the other side. So these things all have the implication that the technologies are changing in a way which is far beyond human institutions. We have nation states, and we have a very primitive global governance system that's 60 years old. We try to understand the future, and all these exponential growth rates in the technologies, the nanotechnologies, the computer technologies, and the financial markets, and trying to think about whether they will simply carry on growing exponentially or whether we reach some tipping points in various things. It's important to realize that it's never simple to try and understand these things ex ante. And even when one is a physicist studying the boiling of water, which changes its state, there is a tipping point which is reached, which is understood by observing it ex post. So these are the graphs of stock markets in the 1920 crash, water boiling, and you see exactly the same sort of tipping point behavior going on, which, you know, someone might guess, but you need to understand the system. And the problem in predicting these risks or changes is that we use similar analytic models. So this is a $2 billion operation of hurricane prediction, and it's just intra within the year prediction of hurricanes in the US. And you see a number of things that come out of the sort of prediction process. The one is clustering, because the same models are used. The second is overreaction. So in 2005, they got it too low. So in 2006, they tweaked their models and got it too high. And the third thing is that they're always wrong. It doesn't mean that one shouldn't do it. It means that even throwing $2 billion at a complex system isn't going to give you an answer. Should they put more money? Should they think about different sorts of modeling methods or different types of computer mathematical equations, which are variant, and then trying to understand which are more effective and so on. Those are the sorts of public policy questions that need to be raised around this. This will become more intense with climate change, and you might be very familiar with these are the IPCC projections. Again, very large variation, However, the direction of travel is consistent in all of them. In other words, climate temperatures moving upwards. I'm a climate pessimist, so I'm sort of at that end of the spectrum, but others, for whatever reason, what none of us incorporates is tipping points and discontinuities that might happen in this. So all of these assume some sort of continuous process. Again, they're one of the major failures of the predictive process. Pandemics is an area where this is again myopic in terms of our ability to think of it. We know historically that pandemics have been the biggest killers of humanity. As recently as 1918, they're killing many more people in the First World War. But we also know that we don't worry about them, and we have to think about why. Some of the doctors will tell us because we have antibiotics now, we have a different response. But certainly our pandemics group at Oxford believes that we will overdue and that we need to worry extremely deeply. Again, because of all the complexity I've been talking about, because of the integration, because of the different factors that I've mentioned, including, of course, population density and asset value concentration, the impact would be far greater than it ever was. We don't actually know how many people died in Spanish flu because partly it wasn't labeled as that everywhere. The information is a long way to come. So we'll know that it happens here, that the doctors analyze it, something will be too late to close the borders. And the world being integrated means the effect will already be going through. So questions like how should we react in that case become extremely important, and that's why our group in Oxford is working on the modelling of a pandemic and drug distribution, and they've done various examples. Do you give it first to those that are most vulnerable? Do you give it to the health workers first? Which groups of people do you distribute it to? They've come up with a conclusion that you should give it to as many people as you can as quickly as possible. That's a very, very important conclusion that they believe could save millions of lives. And obviously they speak into DEFRA and much elsewhere about that sort of conclusion and the robustness. But these are things which, by thinking them through systematically, one can have a dramatic impact on the potential outcome. Biorisk is, I think, the biggest risk facing us all from a security standpoint. And again, how does one cope with this as a society when a really smart person with a PhD from a good university could produce things, pathogens, which would have a major impact. So that obviously raises all the questions regarding the use of the new technologies in surveillance and privacy and so on. The key question in many of these things is, do we react after the event, or do we think them through in a systematic way before? And I've mentioned human modification. Enhancement, there's no part of the body which will not be enhanced if you have the resources to do it. And this raises very, very significant questions, particularly when we get into the discussions on brain enhancement or ability enhancement. There certainly are already drugs available that increase concentration, alertness, and so on. But this is becoming much more systematized so that the people on the frontiers of this believe that you will be able to increase, for example, IQ, whatever that is, by a certain amount, 1, 2, or 3% systematically through chemicals. And this could have dramatic implications. There are studies which suggest that, for example, things like youth going to jail is affected by, if you take the studies on lead, the effect of lead poisoning on people's performance socially, and you translate those into, that's the downside, what happens when you deteriorate concentration and ability, you put that into upside, there are studies that suggest that this could have very, very significant social implications if you were to do this. Obviously, public policy is paramount. Also, for the private sector, do you sprinkle something on your workers' canteen food, enhance their productivity by 5 or 10%, perhaps that's a good thing if they're in a mine and you might have to concentrate on working against machinery or driving a long-distance truck. You think that's a good thing? Public implications are positive. But let's say you decide not to do it, or the UK decides not to do it, and our competitors decide differently, either at the corporate or public level. What is the implication for global competitiveness? So these are very, very important global policy questions. And the question is, who is managing them? And the short answer is, no one. And you can look across the different institutes of the sphere, whether it be on migration, or climate change, or pandemics, or bioethics, some of the global issues regarding pensions and portability and so on, which I'm sure so we'll come to. And what we see is a set of existing institutions which are dealing with problems that arose often out of crises 60 or so years ago. And so the question going forward is, do we need another major crisis, a catastrophe, before we are able to design a global management system which, in a proactive way, will stop these things happening in the future, as Bretton Woods would, for example, after the financial crisis. So this is an absolutely crucial question, and leadership from the UK in this area is very important because it is a thought leader in many of these areas, both on the research, but also the public and global policy dimensions on it. Well, absolutely crucial. What we're trying to do is look at this link between academic research and policy, and I'm not sure if you can read the writing. It says, the grown-ups saying, stupid dog just standing there barking, and the dog is coming out with a sort of a very advanced breakthrough called fusion, and the moral is, can we speak to each other? Can are we simply speaking different languages and not understand each other, or are researchers able to both interpret what is needed and to be heard? So what is this link? And of course it's confused by the fact that you think you have a conversation going with sets of interlocutors in government, but they are bombarded constantly by distractions. And so we get into a very difficult situation, one that I personally find difficult, where I think the aspirational system is obviously democracy and making democracy more effective, but it does mean that it's very difficult to have long-term conversations. What is the incentive structure within democracies to have conversations about 10, 20, 30 years away when you basically be lucky that people are concentrated on tomorrow? So this is a major issue. How does government organize itself in a way that allows it to bring in long-term thinking? And obviously that's what civil services are for, but are they currently performing that function? And how do you have a coherent long-term conversation which helps societies prepare in a more effective way for the long term? And that preparation, I would argue, is absolutely pivotal to deciding whether we're going to evolve upwards or downwards, and whether we become any wiser in our ability to deal with the long term crisis. So this is the purpose of the 21st Century School. You'll shortly hear from Sarah Harper, who directs the Institute of Aging. We currently have another, apart from Sarah's, 9 institutes in the school, focusing on biosciences, the future of humanity, which is these big questions about what humans will look like in 20, 30 years' time in terms of brain enhancement, and e-horizons, which is the interface of internet and society largely, emerging infections, which is the pandemics, environmental change, climate change, forestry, etc. Science and civilization is looking at the broad trends and also very strong scenario capacity. We have the team from that used to be at Shell working there now. Institute of Mind, I think you know Baron Susan Greenfield, who directs that, working on Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and other areas of degeneration. Migration, the only group, I think, in the UK, which is taking both a developing and developed country perspective on migration, and looking at the global sorts of bargains one might think about. And the World Education Institute, which is the outreach. I sit there at that window in the hub of the school. We're adding another 7 institutes from October, doing a lot more science, nanoscience, oceans, this is on tipping points in oceans, ethics and conflict prevention, fascinating new work on cancer therapy, using very directed cancer bombardment techniques. Stem Cell Institute, we're creating for the first time at Oxford, the Stem Cell Institute. We're creating a new program with a chair in energy and non-carbon energy, and then we're working specifically on carbon reduction in transport. So that's us, and that's our website, and we also have the brochure which provides further information. Thanks very much. Thank you.
I'm very glad after hearing that I didn't try and introduce the school myself, because it's far broader than even I imagined. And I mean, I sit on a select committee for the Science and Technology Select Committee now at the Innovation University of Skills, which did some work on evidence-based policy making, and one of the things that we said was if only there was evidence-based policy making, and that included the concept of research impacting on policy. So a lot of the stuff around research at the moment is how it can translate into industry, how it can translate into profit, its development. And it's less mature, I think, the development of the translation of research into policy, or even debate. Our select committee's done work on biorisk, laboratories, it's done work on some of the other key issues like stem cells and the human enhancement. But it's made me conscious of the very superficial way in which even select committee inquiries go into some of these issues. And I think this is tremendously exciting. I just wish there were more parliamentarians here to hear this. I've said this earlier to our speakers. There's no votes today. No lip votes today in the House of Commons, which means people flee the place to go and work elsewhere in their constituency. And we can't pick up any of these things that I don't think we will be circulating. I'm certain people help circulate some of this stuff. So now I think to drill down into some of the programs that are available in just one of these 10 institutions in the program, I seem to be 17. We have Sarah Harper. And I have to say that this is a huge enterprise that we're very pleased and proud of to actually. £100 million donation, running costs of £4 million plus, perhaps £1 million of that funding, and expanding by the way. So it's just a huge amount of work being done, and as we've heard, very critical areas, and one of these areas we're now going to build up.
Thank you. I hope I'm going to be talking about opportunities and not just challenges. The Institute of Ageing, as I'll explain in a minute, is a multidisciplinary institute. And that makes this, I think, very exciting because we have economists and demographers and healthcare people and psychologists and historians and anthropologists and people who work in law and language. And we also relate very closely to the biomedical sciences. And as you will see, we don't just work on care of older people. And this, I think, has been one of the really exciting things to be part of the James Martin School, is that global ageing is a truly global challenge. And being able to link in with other colleagues who are working on migration and infectious diseases and the way that the mind, for example, is changing has really helped us in our endeavour. 20th century, last century of youth, that's what global ageing basically is all about. The UN has recently identified three key challenges for the 21st century. The first is global climate change. The third is global terrorism, and the second is global ageing. And if I say that actually July the 3rd is an important day for me because 18 years ago, at this moment, I was on the way to a hospital to give birth to my first child. So she's 18 today, and one of the things that mothers sometimes do is they make little diaries and collect things together, and you do it in the first few months. So today, this morning, I presented Imogen with a scrapbook that I had made in July 1990, and it didn't just say things like, apparently she rolled over when she was 5 weeks old, which I thought was very advanced, but it also had newspaper cuttings from the time, and I think it is extraordinary that 18 years ago, in a young person who's just become an adult, Germany was not unified, the Iraqi war, the first one had not started, the internet outside academia and a few corporates had really no impact at all. Aging, climate change, terrorism, they were not global issues then. And in 18 years, we have really leaped forward, I think, into the 21st century. These are challenges for the 21st century, partly created by the 20th century and the centuries before. But the key thing is that these, in a way, have been redefined as we entered the 21st century. I'm going to show you a few demographics and then show how at the Institute we are working on these. The Institute basically has four themes and it has four regions. We work on work, retirement and economic security. We work on families, health and communities. We work on biodemography, longevity and health. And we work on technology and education. And all of these are relevant in the world of global aging. And then we have research in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Europe. And most of the research I'm going to talk about today is being worked on in the Institute. If it isn't, I'll refer to colleagues outside. But I think it shows how a multidisciplinary approach can really start taking good quality empirical research but address policy questions. This isn't particularly good, but basically this is where the population of the world is at the moment. These are people aged over 60 years. And what you really have to concentrate on here, which is pink purple, and this is where we have up to a quarter of the world's population aged over 60, The rest of the OECD countries are up to 20%, but the majority of the rest of the globe, as you can see, is still under about 10%. I think a truly staggering statistic is the following. In 20 years' time, half of Western Europe is going to be aged over 50, with a life expectancy at that age of another 40 years. We have never had a society, never had a region of the world, where half the population is aged between 50 and 90. And we're not just going to be talking about care for older people, we're going to be talking about fundamental changes in our institutions, how we alter our work, how we alter our education systems, our hospitals, our transports, our housing, our political systems, our defence systems, if you have half your population aged between 50 and 90. Well, the same year, this is 2020, we're going to have a quarter of the developed world aged over 60, aged over 65, and a quarter of Asia aged over 60. And this is what becomes very clear when we look at this next slide. This is 2050. These are, bearing in mind what Ian said, these are UN median predictions, and the demographers at the Institute obviously work on far more sophisticated predictions, but for a general sweep, I think they're of interest. A new colour has been introduced. That's a third of the population, the green. All the OECD countries, large parts of Asia, are going to have over a third of their population aged over 60. And you can see that the pink-purple covers almost the rest of the globe, particularly the rest of Asia, all of Latin America and the Americas, and they are over a fifth to 25%. And indeed, it is only sub-Saharan Africa where we're still going to have under 10% of the population. This is a truly fundamental change. This is called structural aging. It's a shift in the percentage of the population. But we can also move to look at absolute aging. And this is a graph which has been produced by HelpAge International. And it shows changing across the regions between 1950, 1990, and 2025 in the Oceania, North America, South America, Africa, Europe, and Asia. This is the numbers in 1950. This is the numbers in the different regions. Look at the end. This is Asia in 1990. And by 2025, that's 15 years' time, this is Asia. We will have roughly a billion people aged over 60 in the less developed world. The majority of them are going to be in Asia. And I think here in Europe, we've got to get away from thinking that aging is about old people living in Europe and maybe in North America. It is a truly global phenomenon. And as Ian says, we become more global, or in fact, we very much are global. The part of the world that is going to be aging, where old people are going to live, is indeed going to be Asia. And that's going to have tremendous implications for the world economy, for world migration, as I'll talk about in a minute. Many people think that this is to do with longevity. In fact, it isn't. It's to do with falling fertility. When we look back, what were the signals that we missed at the end of the 20th century? We had no idea how quickly fertility was going to come down. If I say to you what country in the world at the moment has got the lowest fertility, measured by the number of children per reproductive woman, most people here, probably China? Italy? Greece? No. It's actually Taiwan, Hong Kong, both less than one child per woman. Then we go on to Singapore and Korea, 1.2. We start coming into China. Then we come into Italy and Greece and come up through the European countries. Fertility is falling across the world, including in the Islamic countries. Iran has just fallen in 10 years from 4.8 children down to 2.5. And it's only in sub-Saharan Africa where we're still getting those families at 5 and 6. Why did that happen? I think clearly education in its widest sense is probably part of the explanation that not only have we been working for decades in educating women into the labour market, educating them in family planning, then mass education, particularly through things like television, which altered their peer groups. But a very, very simple explanation is that I don't think anyone quite realised that, as in Europe, if you said to women in Asia and Latin America, you can basically go out into the labour market, earn money, or you can stay at home and have children, Asian women and Latin American women would decide to delay their births. And that is probably the main driver behind falling fertility. And if we look at what's happened in Europe, those countries where it's actually very, or reasonably easy for women to stay in the labour market and have children, for example, the Scandinavian countries because of positive parenting, etc., they're the ones that are increasing their birth rates. Those countries where it is extremely difficult to stay in the labour market and have a child, particularly the southern European countries, they're the ones that are having the very low birth rates. So if you want to increase fertility, one of the stories is that you have to tackle the labour market and the relationship with parenting and families. Should we boost fertility? In a minute, I'm going to give you some solutions to the challenge of population aging. And possibly one can say that actually boosting fertility is not the one we should go to. The UN median figures on maximum population, which used to be 12 billion by the end of the century, have now come down to 9 billion, purely taking into account the falling fertility that we have at the moment. Falling fertility is actually good for the world, it's just a matter of getting there. But we also have increasing longevity, as Ian indicated, and we've seen a consistent rise, not only in longevity, but also in healthy life expectancy for the younger cohorts. And the second signal we missed at the end of the 20th century was that we would have mortality falls among the over 65s. We've had consistent mortality increases for at least the last 100 years, but they have been in those groups typically below 65. Now we're seeing falls in mortality in the over 65s. And those of you who will be sitting here, in fact, for almost an hour, your life expectancy in that hour has gone up by about 5 minutes. So whilst you were sitting here 5 minutes ago, do something slightly more interesting. Will it continue? The Government Actuaries Department in this country, which has consistently underestimated increases in mortality, used to talk about the lucky cohort. And that was the cohort born between 1925 and 1935. And that argument was that at every year of birth, every year of life, this cohort benefited from advances in longevity. So in other words, when they were babies, it was public health initiatives bringing down infant mortality. During the war, they benefited from increases in things like getting rid of infectious diseases, the tremendous boom of the 1960s, which increased living standards, and now late-life medicine. So for a couple of years now, I've been going around talking about the lucky cohort. Will longevity flatten in this country? The rate may still go up, but will it not flatten when the lucky cohort has gone through? And a month ago, I went to a Government Actuaries Department symposium where they started talking about the lucky cohort 1925 to 1945. Already we know that the older, the next generation coming in have got the same longevity as those who came in the 10 years before. So at the moment, longevity is probably on the increase. Ian talked a little bit about inequalities. One of the huge inequalities we face, however, is that women born in Japan have a life expectancy of birth of 88. Men born in Sierra Leone still have a life expectancy of about 34. And one of the things we can see across the 21st century is this widening of inequalities in life expectancy and the associated health. Because of these two dynamics, falling fertility, increasing longevity, we're moving into what we can call mature societies. And that is when we have, this is the measure of the percentage of dependents. We now have more older dependents than younger dependents in Europe, and that happened at the turn of the millennium. So more older than younger people in Europe. This is what will happen in Asia. By 2045, there will be more old people in Asia than young people. And again, nobody saw this coming. Now, many people think of this kind of changing demography as some kind of an age wave. People talk about the baby boom. Once the baby boom goes through, this will all change. This is highly likely to change. This is the kind of trend that, regardless of the projections, it is extremely likely that fertility will still fall to some degree and that longevity will still increase. And I think we've got to get away from thinking of that old pyramid shape. The pyramid, which we used to have lots of young people at the bottom fueling our economies, keeping our dependency ratios buoyant, tapering off to not many people at the top, that has basically gone. And what we're moving to is what we can say. I recently had to do a Radio 3 lecture for 29 minutes on demography, and let me tell you, over the radio, trying to keep people awake, and actually having not even being able to see me do things like this really makes you think, how visually can we explore this? And so we came up with the concept of the skyscraper, that we are going to go from the pyramid to the skyscraper, hopefully by the end of this century. And that means that for every floor of the skyscraper, you have one decade of life, or roughly 10% of the population. 10%, 0 to 10, 10%, 10 to 20, etc., all the way up to a tiny peak at the top. And that's a tremendous success story. That means the majority of the people born will live long, healthy, active lives, and then have a very little disability at the top. And we should welcome that. The problem is, of course, that as we get there, so we have to go, in many cases, through an inverted triangle as this already born population go through. If you think that the women who are having one or no children in Asia probably have five or six siblings. It's a huge shelf of people going through, and then it will fall down. We can see this, and these are just some schematic profiles that we've done. This is the US in 1990, traditional pyramid shape with the baby boom at the bottom. Here we have the baby bulge going through in the 1990s, so it's 1960, 1990. And this, as you can see, already moving into that sort of skyscraper, with a little bit of the big boom up here by 2020. This is the success story that the whole world, that we believe, we hope, will eventually move towards. But this is what Japan is going through at the moment, and this is why they're so concerned. 1960, we have the triangle. This is what they're going to face by about 2020. Huge boom here. These are the people with the long, long life expectancies and the very, very low fertility. One of the things I think we have to bear in mind is that whereas in Europe, we went through the demographic transition in about 100, 150 years, and we have plenty of time to plan for this, those countries in Latin America and Asia, they're going to go through the demographic transition in about 20, 25 years. So in 20, 25 years, they'll go from a young to a more mature society, and they are going to have to, at some level, introduce late-life security, long-term care, shift from acute medicine to long-term care medicine, in 25 years rather than about 150 years. So this is the basic demography that we work on at the Institute, and we obviously do complex modeling of this. What I want to do for the second half of the talk is draw on some of our research to look at the implications globally, societally, and individually, because I think we have to say that at each of these levels, individuals are going to be affected, societies are going to be affected, and they're going to be changing global dynamics. And I'm going to concentrate on the world of work. I could take education, I could take healthcare, I could take the environment, but let's just concentrate on the work that we are doing. Globally, we run a very large global aging survey. We now have three waves, 44,000 people in 25 countries in every region of the world, aged between 40 and 80, that cohort coming up to retirement and that cohort post-retirement. And we're looking at changing attitudes, behaviours and expectations. And there's some very interesting messages coming out of that. We also have a large group that are working on migration. As will become clear, I think one of the huge dynamics of global migration have been these demographic imbalances. And we have grown accustomed over the last almost 100 years that the old, mature countries of the North, who are rich, they export economic capital to the poor countries of the South, and the countries of the South who have large numbers of labour because they're young, export human capital in the form of migrant workers. Now, we know that here in the UK, the import of migrants, particularly skilled migrants, has had a tremendous impact on our altering our dependency ratio. I think NHS have announced that without their migrant doctors and nurses, they simply would not be able to continue. And I believe 40% of all new nurse recruits in this country at the moment come from either Africa or Asia. But as we saw, particularly in Asia, they are going to need their skilled migrants because in 2020, that demographic dividend of young people that are currently out there in the labour market are going to disappear when we have those very, very low fertility rates coming through as young people not born to go into the labour market. And Manpower have done some very interesting work which suggests that, yet again, as Ian suggested, we have to look to China, and that China is the only country in the world, and it has documented every occupation by its age structure, and it knows at what year the skills shortage is going to hit. China can't possibly provide the skills it requires. It is going to have to start recruiting skills. And traditionally, as young people choose which occupations to go to, you see that skill shortage shift through the occupation structure. We've seen it very clearly in Europe and in North America. Health and social care is first hit, engineering, manufacturing, transport. IBM has recently announced it cannot get the graduate skills that it needs. HSBC has announced it cannot get the graduate skills that it needs. The skill shortage moves across, and it's really only media and PR at the moment in this country, I think, which can get all the skills that it actually needs. So what China, it is argued, will do is that it will start to recruit the skills from Southeast Asia. And on a recent tour that I did a couple of weeks ago, and I've done it for 3 years now, and I talked to governments, academics and policymakers in different countries in Southeast Asia, they are very aware that China is there and has the potential to suck their skills. And what Manpower predicted is that, first of all, it will be Southeast Asia, then it will be Latin America and Eastern and Western Europe. And by 2030, the brain drain will flip from the US across to China. So if you're a bright young graduate, you won't go and work in First Boston in New York for 5 years, you'll go and work in Shanghai. So we have a global skill shortage coming up, and that is basically as a result of demographic aging, in the light of the increasing demand for world skills. One of the ways, I think, that countries like the UK and other countries in Europe can solve this is by looking at its own population, and in particular, that group aged 50 to 70. Now, we have attracted women into the labour market. At the same time, we have encouraged men and women to leave the labour market. And in this country, we actually have a situation where we say to young people, you stay in education till you're in your 20s, or you can probably retire in your 50s, and you may well live till you're 90. That's unsustainable for a country, and it's unsustainable for individuals to think that in their 50s they can retire with a 40-year life expectancy and have the kind of pension provision that can keep them secure for that length of time. So one of the things we work on in our ageing workforce program at Oxford is trying to understand the value of that age group, aged 50 to 70, trying to understand how to train them and upgrade their skills, trying to understand whether there is declining capacity with old age, and trying to understand what people themselves actually want. And I think the evidence is actually quite clear. It is one of the group that works on skills upgrading and education at Oxford, along with other colleagues, has shown very, very clearly that with the right kind of training, you can train anybody. And between 50 and 70, in fact, our cognitive decline between 20 and 70 is probably such that with the right kind of environment, training and support, productivity that will not need to decline, that it is possible to train people. We have a variety of projects at Oxford looking at changing capacity. We're currently looking at the oil industry, for example. A colleague of ours who's working in Berlin has recently done some very interesting work on the German car industry and has shown that if you take age and productivity, age and experience, because they tend to counteract each other, productivity does not go down with age. Productivity goes down with age alone, productivity goes up with experience, but if you put the two together, his work shows that on 5 of 7 measures, older workers were actually more productive due to their experience than younger workers. But then, of course, part of this is preconceptions and myths that we have to change, and also the will of the people. People are always saying, people don't want to work longer. And I think that is something that, particularly in government, is something that governments are often scared about grasping. But our global ageing survey has shown 44,000 people over 40 were asked, what, in a variety of reasons, would you be willing to take as your number one reason? Do you want to see government reduce taxes? Do you want to have increased taxes? Do you want to have lower pensions? Do you want to work longer, or do you want to be forced to save more? And across the globe, very clear message was, yes, actually, we are willing to save more if you can show us how to help us to save more. But more interestingly, actually, we wouldn't mind working longer. We wouldn't mind working longer in the right kind of environment. And I think one of the key messages that comes out of these surveys and other work that's been done is, if you say to someone at 50, what are you going to do till you retire in 4 or 5 years' time, you'll probably get very little out of it. If you say to someone at 50, what are you going to do for the next 20 years of your productive life? Because it probably, particularly in this country, will be productive. Do you want to work part-time? Do you want to go into flexible working? Do you want to take some time out? Do you want to combine it with education? Then you get the possibility of combining the experience of older people and the energy of young people. And Scandinavian research in particular, as well as the German research, has shown very clearly that age-integrated workforces are productive workforces. So we have a global skill shortage. We need to get skills from somewhere, and we have this reservoir of skills in this country, as in other northern countries, of active, healthy, older men and women between 50 and 70. And I believe with the right kind of support, there is the will there to continue working. What about individuals? How are individuals going to cope with their increasing long lives? My mother's life expectancy at my age was about 77. Mine is 96. If I knew that I was roughly halfway through my life, would I have done my life differently? And I think increasingly we older people, people across the generations are beginning to realise that they do have the liberty to delay certain transitions, maybe delay having children, maybe delay getting married, maybe delay actually settling down to a career. And the flexible life courses are coming in for a variety of reasons, but one of them is probably because people are increasingly aware of these kind of longevities. So far I've just talked about what we call incremental longevity. That's the kind of argument that a colleague of ours working in Illinois at the moment who is working on. And he has pointed out that if we could get rid of the main causes of death and disability in later life, which is cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, let's put aside dementia for the moment, because I'll come back to that right at the end. When we could add 12 years of life expectancy instantly, that means that women in France, or baby girls in France, would have a life expectancy of 100. Does anyone know how many centenarians there are currently? There's about 10,000 centenarians in this country. By 2050, there will be 250,000 centenarians, and by the end of the century, it's predicted there will be 1 million centenarians. This is incremental life expectancy. What about the kind of work that's happening at the James Martin School on really extending life, radical longevity? I think when we're talking about extending everyone's life for about 100 years, most people would say, so long as it's healthy and active, that's a very positive thing. 120, 140, 160. When do we start saying the science can drive us into these long, long lives? But when are we going to stop taking resources from extending lives from those who are yet to be born? This has been taken very seriously by certain governments. For example, the US in 2003, the White House convention looked at the ethical issues of increased longevity, and it identified two very distinct ways that science could be driving us. Number one, it could be extending maximum life expectancy. And number two, it could be extending normal life expectancy. Now, I think most of us would agree that extending the normal life expectancy for most people is probably something that we should be considering. But the idea of extending maximum life expectancy for maybe a very few rich Americans, or maybe some people in China, where the ethics, obviously, enable them to do the kind of research that possibly we can't do here in the West. And we still have people dying in their 30s in Africa. That is where we're going to get this different kind of inequalities. One of the things that a philosopher and demographer are working on at the Institute is this idea of generational succession. We've grown up with the idea that we pass on down through the generations assets and money and power and status. We do it in our families, we do it in our workplaces, we do it in our communities. What happens when you don't inherit from your parents till you're 80? What happens when you don't inherit from your grandparents until you're 80? But these are the kind of longevities that are actually very likely to occur over the 21st century. And what will those dynamics have on the workplace and on our communities and on our politics? These are all issues that I think we need to be considering. I just want to round up by coming to some specific research which really puts this down to the policy level. And again, this is an exciting collaboration in the Institute between one of our philosophers, Kenneth Howes, a demographer, George Leeson, and one of our economists. And what they are doing is they are looking at the different kinds of dependency ratios that different countries are going to have to tackle. And I'll just take you through these last slides and then we will conclude. This actually is some work not done in Oxford, but done in Chicago, and it shows the dramatic increases in early retirement. One of the issues about aging populations and dependency ratios isn't just that people are living longer, it's, as I said, they've been withdrawing from the workforce earlier. And if you just look here, let's just take the case of France. This is, the dark blue is the 1970s, and this is the 1990s, and you can see in that decade, men between 60 and 64 roughly 60% were in the labour market in the 1960s, and that fell very dramatically to under 20% by the 1990s. And what Gruber and Wise very clearly showed was that these countries here, they had particularly incentives within their pension policy to take early retirement. These countries here did not have those incentives. We're talking here about policy and political will to encourage these active, healthy men back into the labour market. And the reality has been modelled by Kenneth Howes and the Institute. What he's taken in these graphs, he's taken actual age, life expectancy at actual age of retirement. In other words, he's combined increasing early retirement with increasing longevity in a variety of different countries. And again, if we just look here, French men, in 1970, when French men actually retired, they had about 10 years in retirement. Now they have about 22. And it's a combination of those two drivers. Again, this can be tackled through policy. So in other words, let's look at the impact on dependency ratios, because every government is going to have different choices to make, and there are different criteria that we can take. What we've looked at here, this is the old age dependency ratio between 1950 and 2050, and this is the young age dependency ratio. And one of the things I think we have to take into account is that, of course, if you look at ageing not just as increasing longevity, but as falling fertility, the shift in the population goes away from young dependents into old dependents. And this is crucial when looking at healthcare costs. We're most expensive when we're born, and we're most expensive when we die. And we, in theory, across a nation, are shifting resources. And you can see that there will be a 66% increase in old age dependency ratios for the UK. Okay, this is here, this is going to be an increase between here and here. So between 1950, we go up, if you take this, which is, what's that, that's about 15, and then we go not that much then. And you can see, this is for Italy, this is why the Italians are so concerned. High numbers of young children under 15, therefore they had a high young dependency ratio. Here, we have the tremendous growth in the old age dependency ratio. So 100% increase, because what we've got 10% here, and here we have up to, this is the 65, so fall here, and then increase here. In Japan, this is why the Japanese are becoming so concerned. Very young population falling dramatically. Increase in older population, and this is the one that you're talking about at the beginning. This is China. Massively young population, very few. Oh, this is the demographic dividend that they're going to have. These are the young people coming through into the labour market, but then falling off quite dramatically. 250% increase in old age dependency ratios. Remember, in between, we've got all those workers as well. So this is just, we've only got the over and the under. And in between, we've got dependency ratio and workers. So in other words, governments have got, or policymakers, can take different criteria. Okay? And here I'm just taking from Kenneth's work three examples. We have the increase in life expectancy, which is here, maintaining a constant ratio between working life and retirement, which is obviously taking into account life expectancy, and maintaining a constant ratio between working age, population, and retirees. In the UK, you can see by this measure alone, it's between 4.7 in the UK and 7.3 in China. If we try and maintain our constant ratio between working life and retirement, 3.7 years in the UK and 6 in China. This is because the Chinese at the moment retire earlier. And to maintain a constant ratio in working age population and retirees, 8 years in the UK and 13 years in China. So, what I think this story says very clearly is that when we think of population aging, if we look at it from a demographic and economic point of view, we've got to shift away about just thinking about an older dependent population. But that older dependent population will be there. It is of concern. We do work on it at the Institute, as do many people, researchers, obviously, here in the UK. But I think one of the things that we try to do at the Institute within the James Martin School is look at it from this global perspective and say all economies are going to face, the majority of economies are going to face an increase in frail, older, elder dependents. We know that demographically that is probably going to occur when people with current cohorts are in their 80s and 90s. And yet, particularly in Europeans, to a certain extent in North America, we live in a society where we're almost defining old age as beginning in our 50s. And what we need to do is look at adulthood, which at the moment, healthy active adulthood, is probably between about 20 and 70, 75. And if we can encourage those people to stay productive and contributory and not rely on pension income or other forms of support, and therefore valuable resources can be shifted to what will inevitably be a growing group of people at 85 plus, then I think that is one answer, not only to the possible pension burden, not only to how individuals are going to cope with their lengthening life expectancies, but also to the other big issue that's going to face the UK, along with other, in fact, most countries of the world, which is the global skill shortage. So I hope by just giving you one example of the kind of work we're doing, showing how we tackle it from a very multidisciplinary point of view, where we have economists and philosophers and demographers and psychologists working together on this particular issue, and looking at it from a global perspective, we can start to address.
But there was more than enough, even without that, to whet our appetite in terms of how that all that could be translated into policy and how we're doing. So I'm going to ask you if you have any questions, but I'd like to thank Professor Harper to ask initially, to what extent do you think the UK government is aware, in the two examples you gave, in terms of still how to deal with potential skill shortages and also incentives not to retire, being paraphrased, is there an awareness in government? Is there an awareness of think tanks beyond universities of this?
I think we definitely have seen a shift over the last 10 to 15 years. And in a way, I feel probably there are people in the audience who can answer this much, much better. From an academic point of view, I think it's very clear that particularly people at DWP are working behind the scenes with Age Concern, Help the Aged, Third Age Employment Network, Age Positive initiatives, etc., to try and get to encourage older people to go back into the labour market. I think in a way, I think there are two issues. One is actually a political will, that there is a concern out there that the electorate is not ready for this. And I think actually, in a way, the world is changing so fast. And I think often individuals actually are moving forward at a faster rate than the structures within which they are constrained or operating. And I think sometimes individuals, when given the kind of choices that we gave them in a research situation, like, you know, what you're going to do with your life after 50, and there will be flexible opportunities, and there will be the possibilities of part-time work, and you can now draw down your superannuation and stay in the labour market. And definitely HR departments that we talk to are becoming much more aware. But individuals are becoming to wake up to that realisation that maybe they don't want to stay in retirement for 40 years and they vote, etc. And that the government maybe is finding it more difficult to take that kind of particular step. But I think probably, to be honest, if you look at what happened to women, women came into the labour market when the labour market needed women. And I think there's this global skill shortage, and you only have to talk to representatives. And I think David Gender from the Engineering Employers Federation has just left us, sadly. And he will, you know, say very clearly that the average age among his members is increasing rapidly. And that in actual fact, and that as different occupations begin to realise that they have to retain the skills of older workers because the labour market needs them, then that's when we're going to see older people going into the workforce. But the problem then is that there will always be a group of people who are not able to stay in the workforce, and that's when it's really important that we have policy structures in place to protect those people who, for whatever reason, cannot continue working in their 50s, 60s or even their 70s.
Very good question. I'm sorry, if you could say who they are, I have some two questions already. Lord Horace.
Alan Dyson, and then ask for it. To the extent that you can generalize this, can I ask a business group that's open to characterize perceptions of listeners of this country? Because the world of the market is the same, the sophisticated intellectual in France, Britain, is completely the level of societies of superstitions
Yes, and so can we put that into hearing, agreeing, and implementing? Because I think there are three stages of them.
I think that's an extremely important question. As someone who believes in the power of ideas in shaping history, it's the transmission between ideas and policy, particularly if one believes, as I do, to evolve institutions and more rapidly to absorb ideas. It's difficult for me to compare governments. What I've been struck by which is about the 21st century school, is how strongly it is for the UK government. There is an interest, and I think many people say, many people across school are finding a very regular interest in the more recipients of their money through such cases. So, even in the last 2 weeks, one of our groups coming up with a speech that he was So there is support coming from that way as well. In a sense, my concern is that these issues require global response. And so one question is going to be to the UK policy audience, deeper questions as well to other policy audiences. That's right. I think what we're fortunate enough to be having is we don't have the anarcho system. Other institutions may move to civil service bureaucracy for the constitution. So we have a very good movement into the civil service. How can we, my worry is the worry that I mentioned, which is I don't, particularly a time like this where you sort of have to change your cycle of view about government, I don't get the sense that there's an ability to act. Some people are interested in your presence here today. My sense is if you try and do things, there's like a resonance for the bishop within institution building. The other irony to me is that the global institutions, which are meant to be thinking long term, are most important for the baggage about long term development. There's absolutely no capacity for that. What do you know? Any one person who's managed his different function, how we start to help other people. And the useful strategy is the best So who is thinking of the national governments aren't global institutions. I mean, I must presume that the intelligence agencies long term. But, I'm not sure they want to interact with us, I'm not sure we're interact with them as our primary interlocutors. And so I think that's a possibility. I'm hoping that the European Union will be able to consider that which will be slightly more financial science, or not for getting the differences as well. And just a little bit the non-democratic change, various findings. So I think that you hit on a real tension. Obviously, this is really a world, and anything that you can speak about having it be disruptive or communicative.
My experience of the Department of Health and Public Education, and now Department of Families, Schools, and Teachers, the old Department of Education. I've been really impressed. I came back from Chicago in 1996, and there I was in the school, professional school of public policy. And it wasn't the Kennedy School, it was the Harris School, but still there were constant interactions, and where there was a lot of influence. How much influence in reality, I don't know. On the ground, I would say that we have members from those three departments who come to our seminars and workshops, they invite us. And one does get a real feel that in devising initiatives and policies, they definitely are coming to talk to academics, they definitely are reading our material, they definitely are commissioning a lot of research. And so, for example, the new Department of Families, etc. initiative on education, I think it has five streams, I think it's all led by academics, and the idea is to help them devise strategy for the next 20, 30 years. And I lead the one on generations and migrants, which is on demography and aging. So they really are thinking very laterally. And I also think we have here two key NGOs, Michael Eck, the Aged, and Mark Borden, Help Aged International. And I think those networks as well, we as academics work very closely with colleagues in NGOs and with other policy groups. And my feeling is that every time that we have meetings and discussions of a formal nature, there are members of the relevant government departments there. So I think the will is there, and how much it eventually gets transmitted is sometimes difficult to listen to.
Area. Gentlemen, the other point,
Should be the question from the LPPR, did you say?
Yeah.
It was about to what extent is fertility an issue? Should we be seeking question saying that Sarah was arguing that whether the tool should not necessarily be trying to increase fertility? To what extent is fertility a tool in this issue?
I mean, that, as you probably know, there is a huge debate between demographers and definitely at Oxford, I think I'd rather to sit on that area that really is actually calling fertility from a public policy and social welfare point of view is actually good, particularly in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And it's good for women, it's good for the environment, it's good for their societies. There is an issue about something called demographic inertia, and one of my demographic colleagues has worked closely with a group in Austria, headed by Wolfgang Lutz, and they've done quite a lot of work which has suggested that when total fertility rate comes down to 1.5 per woman or below the modern generation, it is extremely difficult to raise it up again because society tends to adapt to a low or childless situation. I think the general view is, and again, you know, if we do more sophisticated, as you know, projections, there is this tremendous diversity, although on the whole, most people think fertility is going to continue to come down and probably will settle around about just at or below the median. I think the idea that either migration or fertility will actually come down and settle at about 2.2, which is around about sort of replacement level, more or less either just below or replacement level. I think one of the problems is people have looked at both migration and fertility as a way of solving the aging problem, and I think it's very clear that it is going to be extremely difficult to encourage women to have those kind of levels of fertility that would actually have a dramatic impact on the kind of dependency ratios we will see over the next century. But then it will settle. We do quite a lot of training at Oxford of civil servants, and we have a big group of them from China. And for the last 3 years, we've had advanced leaders from China, which include the head of the municipal boroughs, head of consumer departments, including family planning people. And they always ask, should China abandon its one child policy? And they basically want Oxford demographers to say yes, because then they can go back and say, you know, this is what Oxford demographers think. And I think our answer is socially and morally, that's really up to you. Demographically, it would be a disaster. Because if you look at what China has done, it sort of had that peak in the 1970s, but its actual total fertility rate is now being mirrored by what's happened in Southeast Asia. You know, China has come down to the kind of rates that women naturally are taking up in Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Hong Kong, etc. And that there is a trend that if you ask most women, how many children do you want? They want two. And, if, you know, women don't have to have six children just to have two living. They will probably end up having two. And one of the problems we have at the moment is people are delaying fertility. So average, I think it's a third of women in this country aged 35 would yet to have their first child. And if we see that in Asia, and the evidence is that we have huge numbers of women in Asia now in their late 20s, early 30s, who still haven't had a child, we're not going to be able to have those large numbers. So I don't see increasing fertility in the long term as having good for the environment, being good for, you know, the general population, or as a role in the long term of altering the aging dependence.
I've been engaged, so it's a debate on women's place. which I will ignore in the tradition of academic abstemiousness. There's a question here on the right, and then a question.
Quite difficult to be able to
There's merely minor bumps through the food system, which would actually encourage the cancer and the age
process. And I don't think this is exactly the point. A, we're in the time of transition, but B, often it is policy. There are issues that, you know, will prevent the best that will it is occurring. For example, I think there was a huge inland revenue made a decision recently, 2 or 3 years ago, I think now, that you could stay in your same company and pull down your superannuation and go part-time. Now, without any doubt, that has had a ripple effect, because many people, maybe in their 50s and 60s, want to go part-time, but they want to change employers, and they would like to take benefit from their superannuation. You made a very pertinent statement. You talked about falling off the conveyor belt at 50, 55, 60. That's new. You know, compulsory retirement only came in the 50s and 60s of last century. And if you look, I think it was in 1955 a survey was done, and less than a quarter of large companies had compulsory retirement ages. By 1963, three quarters of large companies in this country did. It was a shift, and it was done probably for administrative and bureaucratic ideas. If you look at early retirement came in the 1970s, really, for a variety of social, cultural, and economic reasons, and demographic. We had the baby boomers coming through. We needed to get rid of the older workers. Up until then, it was unthinkable that someone would retire at 50. We have institutionalized over the last 25 to 30 years the idea that at 50 you started retiring. In the academic world, you don't need to become a professor till you're in your 50s. We still have this idea that you potter on very, very productively well into your 60s. I do a lot of work with corporates, we do a lot of work with IBM, we do a lot of work with HSBC. And one of the problems that the corporate world faces is early promotion. You know, 30, 40 years ago, you would expect to be managing director or head of your branch or whatever, probably in your 50s, even sometimes in your 60s. Now you want to do it in your 30s and 40s. And I've talked at a variety of sort of corporate forums and said this to people, and they say, well, if we don't offer people early promotion, we're not going to get the best young skills. But again, this is something that we have got ourselves in. It's not a natural thing. And I was talking, we educate at Oxford, permanent secretaries, and we had a variety of permanent secretaries came down for a day a couple of years ago, and I and some colleagues from the Institute gave similar talks, and I understand now that in civil service, you know, you want to be a permanent secretary in your 40s or early 50s. And again, that's happened in the last 10 to 15 years, this early promotion. But if you see that we have different cohorts, you know, my 18-year-old and people in their 20s and early 30s, I think they're going to have very different lifestyles. We've moved from defined benefit pensions, which are very much career orientated, to defined contribution pensions. You can take a break now in your 30s, go off and do something else. You can do, you know, concentrate on your children, concentrate on your aging parents, etc. And I think this flexibility that we will see coming in over the next 10, 15 years as these new cohorts move through are going to change. But I completely agree with you that governments have to look at are these little hitches that all along the way possibly prevent employers from doing what they and their employees may be able to do.
The topic, obviously, would be the European case on discrimination, where the courts are going to decide it rather than policymakers decide. There's two questions. We're running out of time, so let's keep the questions short, but there's two there and then one at the back. Okay.
Just a question risks that you've talked about, which are very challenges and interconnectedness. They are so interconnected and straight, it's risky, and you don't have a delivery system in space, it's not necessary to be silos. That's pretty much the interface. So, to what extent do you look at this method of a very structure of the 20th century is suitable?
We'll take these three questions together, if that's okay, so if you remember that, I will if you can't, and then you can remind me of that for me. Gentlemen, next to the question.
So again,
known in the last learning that there needs to be a democratic Nazi to try to make that problem together. Now that's quite interesting. It's probably then the wise answer to that. So you might get a melodic disaster again. You see what I'm saying? So, when we start mixing this and get the language, do we, is there a danger that we need to close ourselves off to other ways to get those sort of patterns that we might get to those workers to describe the system? And that therapy was a good tool indeed. It seems to me very much economic language. What is the technique?
I think just those two, because there's enough there. I mean, there's a middle way sort of one which was always sort of academic at the time, but I remember telling people not to worry about it, and then also not to worry about it. So I don't know the answers to that, but that sort of language, is that academic, or is it media or university? And then the first question as well.
Yes. I think the question whether governments are organized in silos and so to think and do this, is it absolutely the right one. And the same thing can be said of academia. We are organized in even smaller silos, right? I mean, 25 departments. If you want to get on in any of them, the first rule that you're going to learn is don't dabble in others. Certainly if you want to be a professor, because you have to publish in your peer reviewed area, increasingly narrowly. It's an issue regarding British academia. The US and some others are slightly more integrated. But it is a strength, because when you're in an area, you really know what's going on. And so the challenge in terms of doing integrated thinking about the future is to get people who are absolutely either young, like postdoc, or else absolutely established, and then get them to come up with others. And all of that, so in the 70s, a very good example of them, embrace people from lots of different disciplines. But I think the same thing is mirrored in government and getting the joined up government, even on day to day issues, is a major challenge. When you do this at the global level, it's an even bigger challenge. So institutions replicate those divisions. So the bank is run by BFID, and the Treasury Union, the Foreign Office runs another institution. So you get all those coherence problems from government. With often results which are incoherent. So, difficult is a nursing school in Malawi who are trying to improve the health situation in Malawi, and NHS will recruit the nurses. So that happens within one government, when you multiply it across, you get an even more complex situation. So I think it's really important that governments find the space to do a joint up long term thinking. I know the Prime Minister's strategy is part of that, you're explaining the message from what I understand. But finding that place where serious long term thinking be done and giving it credibility. So, a lot of this happens in the intelligence agency, the US does it, the National Security Council, and so on. But that's then a very particular lens on the issues and doesn't support. Just on the, when I touched on the question, I know Sarah would pick it up. Language. I think that's right. It would be wrong to say that the 21st century was mainly economist to economistic. The great joke for me, it's been my life as an economist to economist, is that it's dominated actually by philosophers and scientists. So the biggest single group I think we have is 7 philosophers and scientists. And then there's a lot of people in physics and whatnot scientists. But I think that the point you make is a good one. So we need to be very careful that we retain the very clear sense of what we're doing is speaking from the level.
I think this is a really excellent question. Because I worked in the School of Public Policy in the US, I have an anthropologist, as COVID anthropologist and lots of anthropologists. I've actually been as a journalist and then came back into history. So I'm very multidisciplinary, but very much academic myself. Then when I went to Chicago and really discovered there this world of public policy, and then I came back to Oxford, I thought, this is what we need to do. So we don't do policy research, we do academic, empirical, theoretical, methodological work, which has policy relevance. When I started appointing people to work with me, not only did I, because I'm an anthropologist, not only did I want to work with the statisticians, economists, people who complemented the approach I took, but I took my first two appointments with two people who were both Oxford academics, an Oxford philosopher and an Oxford mathematician, who for part of their life had worked one in a policy unit and one for an NGO. Because I wanted them, you have to have particular skills to be able to combine academic research and yet understand the policy relevance and understand the sort of real world, not only in devising the questions, but also transmitting the evidence. So what you talk about in a sort of policy world is something that maybe for the last 10 years at the Institute, because members of us within the Institute existed before the James Martin School, and then we joined the James Martin School. So this is something that we debate and think about a lot. And we have now had to do it in the corporate world, because we've started doing quite a lot of corporate work. And I think what is very interesting is both in the corporate world and in the world of government. We will do 4 or 5 years worth of research, and we will then write a report which may be 20,000 words long. From that, we then have to distill it down to some briefing documents that probably are 10 pages long. And from that, government departments, corporates, will produce 12 bullet points. And in a way, that is also the world that we live in. It is how do you get serious academic research and make sure that the key messages are not only relevant, but that they can be transmitted and understood to the world of the media, policy, corporate world, in a way that doesn't lose either the academic and research relevance. So it's a really important issue, and it's something that in the Institute and I think within the school, we behind the scenes think about.
I know from Central, but would you rather, it's a fair question there, would you rather talk purely academic knowledge not get noticed, or would you be prepared to so certainly in press releases and public talks, which are in German, happy to use language that makes people notice.
I mean, I am, and my colleagues and other colleagues at the school, as I say, are, I think, a particular kind of academic in so much as we publish in very high profile academic journals. We give very high profile lectures and talks. The philosopher that I work with, he doesn't enjoy doing public talks. Two or three of my other colleagues are very, very good at it. And to a certain extent, being able to transmit that kind of material to the general public is actually a skill. And I think within the 21st century school, it's important that we have those people who have those skills and those people who don't necessarily need them because they're the ones doing the research. I personally enjoy all of it. I love giving a really detailed academic talk, but I also, maybe because I've been previously back there, I'm very comfortable doing sort of media at the most of the basic presentation. So I think it's just a spectrum.
In science, it's a good thing to be able to talk in language that the media understand. I would say that the NHS doesn't recruit directly against the private sector.
They do it for stop with the recruitment agencies do it.
That's right. Right, there's a question at the back, but it's gone. There's time for one more if there are any. Yeah. Alan,
yes.
I'll be spotted.
I think those aren't the schools top three level. Those I think those are amongst the top three. Challenges. I would worry that terrorists in this next state, because of the point I made about the power of individuals to do the part. It's a version of Martin Rees's argument where he says, Martin Rees and the background essentially, as both of them, some of the exploitation, so that would be essentially put away with big bucks and big bang, small bucks. Which is Mavericks, who can be immense harm. And I think that potential is growing, so the ability of individuals to make them, destroying, and it appears that the number of, this is a difficult thing to argue. Certainly there's enough fundamentalists who want to there's no evidence that it would find it. But even if there's only a handful of them, the name that can create is so great. So it might be that the number of tourist instances will have its impact at any one incident, potentially, is greater. And then you combine that with the argument for a layer of complexity and integration. So not just greater because the records, the user have a greater impact. You may buy it, I would also argue that one of the growing inequality and the failure of global governments to deal with inclusion at the global level is that it's exacerbated perceptions
very much, and that's one area where the data is actually sometimes secret. So, it's unusual in academia that the raw material is held by intelligence agencies and other people. It's more difficult to justify assertions that have been effect. That would make sense. I'd like to conclude by thanking, firstly, our two speakers for not only their presentations, which were hugely interesting for me, more than others, local MP, parliamentarians, and interested in some of those policy areas. But also the way we took questions and developed some of our ideas. The challenge, I think, for us is to find a way of ensuring that, and it takes on myself, more parliamentarians can look at some focused areas, some of these issues, to be assured that the government and NGOs and think tanks are engaging, but be blatant voluntarians, particularly in terms of questions from the funding research. And education could see what work's being done, and if it's not, shouldn't all be subject to both action, which we're thankful for. I'd like to thank everyone for coming and staying to hear what's been said and for your questions. Again, thanks to Oxford University staff, and particularly for doing the organisation. And please feel free if you've got any room for the longer sort of community and chat.